Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
We do some detective work today, kiddo.
We are.
Some fun detective
work.
It's totally.
It's like somebody else has already done the major detective work for us. But yeah, uncovering the true facts about lichens.
Facts.
And then David Deardorff and Catherine Wadsworth's book, that's hard to say, What's Wrong With My Plant and How Do I Fix It? Just fabulous book that really takes you through the steps of doing some good detective work in terms of finding out what's wrong with your plant, whether it's flower, foliage, stem, etc. So we're excited.
Yeah, it's become a cliche, pejorative to say like horticulture for idiots, but this is one where it's diagnostic for idiots because anybody can use this book.
I think so. And even for the smartest too, because it just really lays it out.
It's easy.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So
where was this book 20 years ago?
Yeah.
We didn't know nothing.
Yeah, exactly. So very excited about that. And then David Gorig and Jim Chatfield at Ohio State University have put together a fact sheet on lichens to sort of, you know, explain this crusty little organism that people find out in their gardens and think that it's absolutely just a dreadful, damaging thing.
Yeah,
and it's not.
And you made a comment that was really kind of neat. You said it's just sort of just there.
Mm-hmm.
Lichens are just there in a little world of their own. It's this amalgamation of two creatures that independently don't get along so well, but together they do very well.
Yeah.
And it's a great explanation of what it's all about and really how helpful they can be and harmless they are.
Right, and how we should appreciate them instead of be afraid of them, right?
That's right.
All right, so that's coming up today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Success everywhere, kiddo. I might have mentioned earlier that I'm so happy about I moved my peonies, and I worried about the too deep or too high thing. They're just perfect.
Good.
Oh, just wonderful. I moved about 30 of them, and it was a worry for me.
Right.
My blueberries are setting.
Good.
You know, I acidified the soil over the years. We had a lot of the acidifier stuff. A heavy, heavy set. I got to get some netting now and keep the darn birds out of here. And my strawberries are incorrigible.
Yeah, so are mine, actually. So are mine.
So peonies, blueberries, and strawberries.
So you've got some good eating and some pretty bouquets of flowers coming into the house,
And the last two I didn't have until about 2 or 3 years ago.
Right.
So somebody on this show has influenced me a little bit.
I guess so.
Break out the berries.
I guess so.
How about the wishy
estate? So good for you, too.
I know.
So good for you.
I already lost 27 pounds.
Well, you don't need to lose weight, but it's like really good for your brain.
Huh?
Yeah. All right. At home,
I'm
kind of deciding that if you just paid attention to nature a little bit more and maybe had your windows open at night, who would ever need a calendar or a clock?
Well, they didn't for a few million years.
Exactly.
Calendars or clocks showed up,
But you still totally knew what to expect just by listening and observing and like the correlation part of nature.
Yep.
So listen to this.
Okay.
Mockingbirds. I swear, unfortunately, I'm awake at this hour, but at 5:45, our resident mockingbird.
Oh.
Psh, 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 psh,
yep.
Psh, psh,
get up.
And then stops.
Our cat does that, but go ahead.
6 o'clock.
Yep.
15 minutes. 6 a.m.
Right on the minute, pretty much?
I'm like looking at my clock, right?
What a bird.
And paying attention.
Yeah.
15 minutes later, 6:15. Stops.
The Simpsonville bus.
6:30.
This is amazing.
6:30, it's full tilt boogie.
Wow.
But for 15-minute intervals, three times, just a clear call out, right?
Yeah.
Still dark out.
Okay.
6:30, it's the full song.
I'll be darned.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. That is amazing.
It's like, and I'm laying there thinking, who needs a clock, an alarm, if you've got a reliable mockingbird outside your window? And when I was in grad school in Tucson, and way back in the day, there was a mockingbird that pretty much sat on the telephone pole outside of my little house and sang like all night long, though.
Wow.
Kept me up.
Is this a daily event now, or it just happened at one particular morning, or do you
it's
know?
Every morning
at the same time?
Yes. Amazing.
Wow.
It is amazing.
What a great bird.
Yeah.
Now, do they attack you when you come outside, though? Ours are a little bit feisty.
Not right now, but they do probably when they're
mating,
nesting. Yeah. So,
and who wouldn't?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and mostly they don't attack us as much as they attack the cats or attack the dog.
It's another reason not to have a cell phone.
This is true, and I still don't have a cell phone.
The Mockingbird can tell you what time it is.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Bring it to town.
And we do know what time it is around Louisville. It is May. It's spring. There's lots of gardening events as well, Bob, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. Bernheim has this really grand Bloom Fest. It's a great event. May 15th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., they have plant sale, woodland fairies, kite flying, nature discovery stations, live music. Bernheim's a great place, and it's a great show on the 15th. Another one of the best tours, I think, in Louisville is the Kilgore Tour. It's Inspiration, Six Beautiful Gardens, One Beautiful Weekend.
It's
Saturday and Sunday, May 15th and 16th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Go to our website for information on the tickets, but it's rain or shine.
Rain or shine.
It's a great tour, Six Gardens.
Yeah, rain can't keep gardeners away.
No way.
Also on Sunday the 16th, this is a fundraiser for the Louisville Nature Center, but they're going to bring folks to my farm to visit Swallow Rail from 1:30 to 3:30 on May 16th. You can come out. They also have a box lunch. So, you know, there's a member fee and a non-member fee, but they do want you to register since they do have the box lunches. But Louisville Nature Center, they do so many great programs. So if you want to check out what I've been talking about, it's a good opportunity to do that and also support their efforts in terms of education. Of course, the Louisville Nature Center is there on Illinois Avenue, right across from the zoo. But you can call 458-1328 or go to our website for information on the Louisville Nature Center and make your reservations for May 16th if you'd like to come out.
And let me add, folks, the Wishy Estate is really something. Janine is a hands-on. Shane, I'll talk. The girls out there pulling weeds and planting plants. And it's a spectacular place, begun by her dad and carried on very well by her daughter. And
it's
a great chance to see it.
Thank you very much.
You betcha.
Another thing that is going to be happening here pretty soon that I'm excited about, May 23rd, the Louisville Visual Art Association is going to partner with Grasshoppers Distribution. They have this like plein air paint out contest down at the Louisville Visual Arts Association, you know, the water tower on River Road. But they're also going to have a Buy Local First Fair. And the Buy Local First Fair, it's going to be unique, you know, homegrown agricultural products, retail, service industry, arts, and cultural offerings. I think over 140 different vendors. So I'm going to definitely check it out and maybe try to get some. I don't need any vegetables, but I sure do like some of our locally produced other agricultural products that I don't have. So we'll get you more details on that, but that's going to be May 23rd.
And will there be any lichens there, do you think?
There could, I would say, maybe down around the water tower, there'd be loads of lichen.
Lichens everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a subject that I've read about and thought about it for a lot, but don't really know much about.
It's confusing.
We're about to solve the problem. We've got two men from the Ohio State University Extension Service, Dave Gorig and Jim Chatfield, who wrote a paper on lichens. And now they're going to deliver the paper to us verbally. Gentlemen, welcome to Homegrown.
Oh, it's great to be on.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's talk first, Jim. I mean, what in the heck is a lichen, say, as compared to moss or mold or fungi or other things you might know something about?
Well, there is an old saying. It's when an alga and a fungus take a lichen to each other. So it's actually, you know, a little bit silly, but it's actually a dual organism. So it is a combination of a fungus and an algae. And it's very specific. It's not all fungi will do this. Not all algae will do this. So it's two organisms that are living together in a beneficial symbiosis. So it helps both of the partners in this kind of unique symbiosis.
Mm-hmm. So, Jim, do certain things have to be in place for this symbiosis to take place?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're not real picky in the sense that lichens live on a wide variety of substrates. But, you know, the key thing is really kind of relates to the two different parts of the symbiosis. You know, fungi, for example, don't make their own food, so that's, you know, one of the ways that they're really not plants.
Mm-hmm.
Algae, or the cyanobacteria, the blue-green bacteria that are you know, kind of in the new classification, used to be called algae, but are now bacteria. They are the photosynthetic component. So for one thing, one requirement is going to have to be some form of light so that photosynthesis can occur, carbon dioxide and water and energy from a light source such as the sun is critical. So you need light. So that's for the algal component of the symbiosis, is that you need some light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to need water and minerals, and that's kind of what the fungus is able to do. The fungus really attaches to the substrate, so therefore it's picking up that water and minerals, and then the food for this organism is put together by the photosynthesis occurring. So you need light, you need a substrate to live on, water and minerals.
Okay. Huh. So how about if we do a little tag team, and we'll move to Dave. Give people an idea, if they're not familiar with what a lichen actually looks like, what are they typically going to look like if we encounter them out in our landscape?
Sure. Well, as Jim mentioned, they grow on many different kinds of substrates. It can be wood, it could be brick, any kind of stone, even old parking lots that don't get used much.
Huh.
Lichen will start to develop. They come in three different forms. One is called the fruticose form. A fruticose lichens is, it's a multi-branched organism, if you will. It comes up like a little tree, a miniature tree, and it branches out.
Mm-hmm.
That's fruticose. Foliose lichens is something that looks like, as the name implies, foliage. So foliose lichens would be a group of lichens that together look like a bunch of leaves glued to a substrate.
Hmm.
Then the last one is crustose. Crustose lichens, they give an appearance of a crusty surface. So whatever substrate they're on, they kind of exemplify or multiply that lookout.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably what most people encounter if they find them on their dogwood or something like that, wouldn't you say? The crustaceous.
Yeah, they come in all different colors as well. And mm-hmm. as Jim mentioned again, with the mineral aspect, a lot of the colors that they come in are a result of the mineral, available minerals that are around.
Okay.
And they grow in all climates and all countries in the world, as I understand it.
That is correct.
Yeah. How big will they get and how long will they live?
Well, that's a good question. And in terms of, individual, it's always tough to tell with some of these kinds of organisms, you know, what is an individual and what is a colony that is, you know, constantly kind of reproducing and adding to itself. But they can live for long periods of time. I mean, hundreds, thousands of years. These are very, very tough, long-lived organisms.
Mm-hmm. But you know, Dave, it's like it's one thing for gardeners, at least, to see them on old rocks and faraway places, but it's mm-hmm. another when they see them growing on their plants and they get concerned. And I've always been taught that lichens did no damage to trees whatsoever. Is in fact that true?
I can tell you this much: that as you know, a fungi, when it invades a leaf, the spore germinates and shoots down through the cuticle of the leaf and into the leaf itself to attack the plant and get nutrients. Lichens doesn't do that. It seems to rest on, it does adhere to the surface of the leaf, but it doesn't appear to penetrate into it.
Mm-hmm.
The key thing is the lichens that do live on plant material, and as we said, they can live on rocks, they can live on plants. The lichens that live on plants tend to live, for example, on the bark, and they live on already dead organic matter or not living organic matter. So they're living saprophytically on non-living organic matter rather than saprophytically actually penetrating and causing an infection, and so therefore being a disease-causing fungus.
Well, they're kind of like in their own little world, just there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are they prehistoric? They go back a few hundred million years as such?
Yeah, very ancient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they apparently don't do damage to plants, right? Do they actually help in any way?
First of all, if you have lichens in your landscape, it kind of gives your landscape a mature look.
Mm-hmm.
A look like it's been there and it's like moss growing on rocks. It's a much nicer effect than if it's just a newly installed landscape with no moss. And I've even heard of places around the country that are actually selling rocks, and they get more money for them if there's lichens attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does them in? Is global warming a problem? Are they dying off in different places, or do you know?
Well, they need moisture. We know that.
Right.
And when moisture is scarce, they will sometimes shrivel up and give the appearance that they're dead. But just a little bit of rain, and it'll wake them right back up, and they'll resume their lifestyle. Now, you can pick them as insects and animals do, and use them for housing and bedding and sheltered materials. Those don't seem to come back once they've been torn off of the colony or the plant that they were living on.
One thing we do know is that there are certain lichen symbioses, in other words, again, this combination dual organism, there are certain types of lichens that are pretty intolerant of certain air pollutants. So we do, you know, we always make a point about, maybe a little bit too much sometimes, but we do make a point that lichens are usually good thriving lichen growth, at least for certain species, really is dependent on fairly non-polluted atmospheres. And so we do know that certain species of lichens were really limited in terms of their survivability and, you know, really the beginnings of industrial England when there was tremendous levels of air pollutants. So we sometimes do say that a lichen is an indicator of a clean air environment. We don't want to go too far with that. And the fact is, I would say that the general occurrence of lichens on Earth is not threatened by our current level of air quality problems we have. But in certain situations with certain lichens, they are a little bit limited by air pollutants. So they're kind of an indicator in some cases that pollution isn't too bad. But certainly I would not say that lichens are typically an endangered organism in the sense of on a wide scale.
So roaches and lichens are going to inherit the world, apparently.
Well, yes, they, you know, the lichens and the cockroaches are going to be there long after us. That's probably right.
And dandelions. Right. So I was intrigued to learn that they actually have a nitrogen fixing capability as well and can actually return something to a plant that they may be housed on.
It's a long-term deal. I mean, I don't think you're going to get significant nitrogen fixation or changes in the nitrogen cycle in a garden from an agricultural point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long, long, long haul, the fact that these organisms are kind of part of the nitrogen cycle and kind of release nitrogen during certain periods, you know, they're really kind of part of breaking down rock over long periods of time. So not in a gardener's life, but in the general sense of how soil gets made from rock, lichens can play a role there. And one of those roles is the fact that we do have these cyanobacteria that are part of that process that can help convert nitrogen.
Are they ever poisonous in any way?
There have been situations where certain lichens have been harvested, you know, kind of as a health food additive and those kinds of things. And there have been some incidents where people really concentrated large amounts of certain lichens and had that be significant portions of diets where people had some kidney problems. So, you know, as with anything else, you've got to be aware of you know, what you're harvesting, how you're actually preparing it, how much of it you're having, and how that plays to the individual human organism. So lichens have been used by food by a number of societies and certainly by a number of different species of wildlife. But willy-nilly eating massive amounts of lichen is something that you should always pay a lot of attention to in terms of getting good information on which species you're looking at.
This is usually a question we ask first, but I want to kind of close with this one because you guys are so fascinated by this subject.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about lichens that so draws your attention?
I would say, if I could start,
Sure.
My interest in lichen came from our extension office here. We receive a lot of calls each and every year about these organisms, and I became fascinated with them because I wanted to make sure we were giving out accurate information to the folks who call into our extension office.
You sort of have to defend the underdog a little bit, too. Do you know what I mean? Convince people that they're all right and that they're wonderful and we should appreciate them.
Yeah, and I think my interest is very similar. Number one, they are interesting. You know, whenever you have these dual organisms, it's really kind of a fascinating way that organisms interact, and so they're a particularly interesting aspect of that. But I think, again, as Dave says, from a horticulturalist point of view, we do have to defend them because there are many, many people who assume that they are causing damage.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to spray copper compounds. They want to use power washers on their trees. They want to get rid of this growth that's going to cause them these problems. And the fact is they don't need to be doing that. And you know, one of the real problems, and you got at it earlier with some of the questions, was that people do sometimes see that lichens increase on stressed plants, and so they assume a cause and effect. What mm-hmm. typically is happening, of course, is that when a plant does decline for other reasons, root rot, diseases, all these other kind of things, and you maybe have some branches that die back, mm-hmm. one of the things that happens is more light impinges on that plant. So with more light, the algal part of the symbiosis is thriving. Mm-hmm. So the lichen is thriving. People notice the lichen more and assume that it caused the dieback. Instead, it was simply benefiting as a dual organism from the greater impact of light on the surface that it's on. So, yeah, we have to kind of, as you say, defend people's, you know, saying, what do I do to get rid of these crazy things? I can't stand it. You know, it's beetles and now it's this stuff. But they're not causing any damage.
Great.
Well, Dave and Jim, thanks a lot. It's been fun to talk about lichens.
Yes, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Dave Gorig and Jim Chatfield are with the Ohio State University Extension Service. For more information on lichens, visit our homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we learn how to diagnose real plant problems and fix them. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Miss Wishy, you ever been asked at a party, in a public place, on a street, under a park bench, what's wrong with my plant?
Oh, never.
And what can I do to fix it?
Never.
I haven't either.
Oh, yeah.
Never.
But actually, I have learned so much from this fabulous book, What's Wrong With My Plant and How Do I Fix It, by David Deardorff and Catherine Wadsworth, sort of to, I guess, address those yep. questions so that everybody learns a little bit more than just, hey, there's something wrong with my plant, or my plant's dying all of a sudden, and it maybe wasn't all of a sudden, right?
Yeah, it's a great book. It's kind of like a CSI horticulture.
It really is.
You get to investigate things. It's kind of yeah. fun to work your way through and figure out from what you see on any particular leaf. You don't even have to know the name of the plant. Uh-huh. Just look at the leaf, the problem with it, and work your way through this book.
That's right.
It's voila.
Totally unique, and I think will become a favorite for many people. And joining us today to talk about the conception and actual penning of this book is David Deardorff. David is a botanist, a plant pathologist, nurseryman, and author. He has a PhD in botany from the University of Washington. He coordinated plant pathology research when on the faculty at the University of Hawaii. He taught master gardener programs while on the water resources faculty at Washington State University, and he continues to do that along with his wife, Catherine Wadsworth. He also co-founded Plants of the Southwest in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of the very first native plant nurseries in the U.S. So clearly a lot of experience all over the country, yeah. which is going to teach you something about plants as well, I suspect. But he's also the co-author, along with his wife, Catherine Wadsworth, of What's Wrong With My Plant and How Do I Fix It? David, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sure. You and Catherine, it seems to me, have spent a great deal of time connecting with people over plants. So was the book sort of a natural extension of this? You know, the ultimate question is, what's wrong with my plant all the time?
Yes, it was absolutely a natural extension of our life together over the last many years, but also for me as a professional botanist and plant pathologist, mm-hmm. as soon as people find out what I do, what my background is, that's the first question they ask me. It's, what's wrong with my plant?
Right.
You never go to a party, do you?
Yeah.
No.
Stay home, man.
So, you know, I've been answering that question for 30, mm-hmm. 35 years,
yeah,
something
right.
like that. And then, especially when I began teaching the Master Gardener program, actually, Catherine and I have been teaching Master Gardeners every winter now for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the book also grew out of that program because it's so, one of the major tasks, volunteer tasks for Master Gardeners is to do plant clinic where they sit at a table and answer that same question, what's wrong with my plant,
right.
for clients in the community. And this book is a big help to them as well.
Well, the layout is unique in the sense it's like a flow chart of what's wrong with my plant, and you just take people through from the photograph of, you know, a particular hole in the leaf or a fungal look to it or a brown spot, and you go through to page, and bam, you land on the solution. Is this concept kind of unique to publishing? I've never seen it before.
It does seem to be unique, I know almost all of the reference books that are available, well, everyone that I know of that deals with plant problems, you have to know the name of the plant before you can begin.
Right.
And so I felt very strongly that I wanted this to be independent of plant name. As long as the plant has a leaf, it doesn't matter what the plant is or where it is, a leaf is subject to certain issues. And the same is true of the flower or the stem or the root system. And so that's why we built the book the way we did. And we chose to use flowcharts because it is so much fun for folks.
We've
learned that they really enjoy being detectives.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, just like a forensic scientist, you're on a quest to discover the reason for the problem, and it's kind of like a game. It's fun.
Mm-hmm. And so our readers understand, you have these pictures of leaves and fruit and stems in color with the various ailments shown, and then you just kind of follow the color all the way through. It's very easy to use. And you're right, you don't need to know what kind of plants you got, just what mm-hmm. the problem is.
That's right. We tell people that the first thing they have to do is observe the symptom. You know where the symptom is on the plant, observe the symptom, and then the questions in the flowchart are always in pairs. They come two at a time, and only one of them can be right.
Yeah.
That's the key, I think. I guess, too, what I really like about the way it's set up, in addition to this unique flowchart system, because it really, it almost seems like a no-brainer now that you've done it. Do you know what I mean, David? Yeah. It's like, but of course, this is really the only way to make a true diagnosis and understand what's really going on with the plant. But I guess we have to step back a little bit and realize that so many people only notice once the damage is done, right? And they don't even really understand the whole sort of what a plant does, what a plant is, and it's the whole of the plant's environment that may cause some of these problems. So in your mind, what are some of the key questions people have to ask themselves when they're looking at their plant to make this diagnosis?
Well, I think a good place to begin, you know, if you're looking at the book, of course, all the questions are, mm-hmm. are written down. Hopefully, all of them are there for you. But, you know, without the book, even conceptually, the place to begin is with the environmental and cultural conditions. Because about 80% of the time, if something has gone wrong with the plant, it's the physical environment or the cultural environment where the plant's in the wrong place. It's either too much shade or too much sun, too much water, not enough water. It's too cold or it's not cold enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of those factors account for probably 80% of plant problems that are encountered.
Mm-hmm.
If in thinking about it conceptually, you've gone through all the factors you can think of for the environment and the cultural environment, that is the way it's pruned, the way it's fertilized, you know, how it's managed by the gardener. Then the next thing would be if it's a pest, if there's some sort of a critter, an animal involved that's a pest,
right.
Then it's almost always an insect of some sort. And if it's not that, if it's a disease, then it's usually a fungus.
Mm-hmm. You're pretty clear in your introduction that the thing that you want to encourage people to do is no harm, primarily to the environment. So most of the recommendations are going to be natural or organic, or us changing that cultural environment.
Right.
So getting people off of chemicals to fix some sort of problem that may exist. Is that something that you've gotten very good reception from? Are people clearly interested in trying to, I guess, be more responsible in terms of managing their gardens?
Oh yeah, people all over the country are
are very interested in an organic approach to managing their personal space these days.
Mm-hmm.
We found that everywhere we go. And the National Garden surveys have recently kind of been pointing out that it's the fastest growing segment of the gardening market mm-hmm. nationwide.
So, David, can we do maybe an exercise in diagnosis and cure?
Sure.
We could pick any number of things from a flower bud that shrivels up and drops off to a wilted foliage to stems or trunks that have cankers or, you know, something on there. Is there something that you think is illustrative, more or less? Something that we can pick and kind of follow through with the flow chart?
Let me help you a little bit. Like on page 44, the category is the leaf is wilted, limp, and droopy.
Okay.
And your question is, are some but not all the leaves wilted? Yes. Then you get down further. Are the wilted leaves mostly normal in color, or do they have small areas of discoloration? If yes, you go below that. Mm-hmm. Are the wilted leaves slightly discolored at their tips or edges? Yes. Below that, are the wilted leaves translucent at their tips? So you've gone from a wilted leaf to translucent at the tip, and your diagnosis you think is insufficient water and tissue damage.
Right.
Just like that. Then you refer them to the back of the book, page 231, for the solutions. It's
right.
Just magic.
It is magic.
Yeah, it works very well. And actually, right on the right-hand couplet that's right next to the one that's translucent at the tips, the leaves are brown at the tips.
Yeah.
That's just simply a later stage of the same issue.
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
Where that translucent area, the cells have now all died and turned brown.
Mm-hmm. What's the most vague question that you used to get that maybe could be an illustration?
Oh, the most common kind of problem?
Yeah.
Very often, people will, you know, they'll have a sort of a dried up leaf in their purse or in their
right.
pocket, and they'll drag that out and show it to me and ask, you know, what's wrong with this? And very often there'll be some sort of a spot on the leaf, and they don't know what that is, and it's pretty common. Those are all fungus diseases, usually different kinds of fungus diseases on the leaves of the plant.
Uh-huh.
There's another thing that can cause spots on the leaf, and that's bacterial diseases. And in that case, the shape of the spot differs from bacteria to fungi. Fungal spots are usually round, and bacterial spots usually become angular because the bacteria often can't get through the veins in the leaf, so they get stuck inside there and get points on them and become angular.
Uh-huh.
Fungi are much more adept at eating right through those veins, and so the spots kind of stay round.
Okay.
Now, what if the leaf had a part chewed out of it, and there's a million possibilities? Kind of walk our listeners through how you diagnose a chewed leaf to a solution in about four steps.
Oh, sure, yeah, because the chewed leaf, you know, chewed leaf has holes in it, and so it's the position of the holes, you know, where the hole is in the leaf, whether it's in the middle of the leaf or on the edge. The second thing is the size and the shape of the hole, because that can be very diagnostic. And if you go to page 51,
mm-hmm.
you can see
I'm there.
You know, the first question is, are the edges of the leaf chewed away, or is a big chunk of the leaf missing,
mm-hmm.
or
right.
even the whole leaf missing? Because in lots of parts of the country, you know, deer are a huge issue in gardens. And deer, when they chew on the leaf, they take big chunks out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could be your neighbor's horse, or even their llama, you know.
Or my chickens.
Bawk, 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 bawk.
That's right.
Well, are there geographic problems? I mean, a particular hole in Florida may look the same as a hole in Washington State, but it's a different bug.
Well, it might be a different bug. If you look at the middle couplet on page 51,
mm-hmm.
Where the holes in the leaf edges are circular.
Right.
Those are caused by leafcutter bees, and there's several species of leafcutter bees around the country, but they pretty much all do the same thing. And they actually, the holes that they make in the leaf, if you look on page 350 at the photo of a rose leaf that's been attacked by leafcutter bees,
right.
You can see that those holes actually They look like they're made by a machine.
They sure do.
You know, it kind of looks artificial.
Yeah.
But it's totally natural. That's exactly the way that rose looked in my garden.
It looks like a child had fun in the garden with a hole punch.
Yeah,
exactly. It really does. So what's cool, too, I think, the first part of the diagnostic steps with the flow chart, David, are illustrations that are really straightforward. And then the last part of the book are actual photographs that illustrate a real plant somewhere that's experiencing this particular problem, which I think the coupling of those two things further our ability actually to really diagnose the right thing.
That's right, and I'm glad you said that, because I did all of those drawings in part one, particularly because, Catherine and I are avid birders, and the best bird books use drawings instead of photographs for their, to identify a bird, because the drawing is more generic, and a photograph is very specific. And it's easier for people to look at a generic kind of drawing and extrapolate from there, whereas if they're looking at a photograph, they might say, well, my leaf doesn't look like that.
Right.
You know, I'm looking at a maple leaf, not a rose leaf, so it can't be the same.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we chose the drawing for the first part. And then, yes, once they get to an accurate diagnosis, they then go to part three, the photo gallery, to verify their conclusion.
I love it.
A chapter worth its weight in gold, if not the money for the book alone, is the problems in the photographs of weird growths like bumps, warts, and things on your leaves and trees. Because everybody has that, and they think it's something from Mars or something, but you pretty well explain what each one is. The galls and those kind of things.
Yeah, there can be, there's so many things that can cause bumps and warts, on the plant. So, we got some good examples of those.
And additionally, some insect identification tips in terms of good insects versus maybe not so good insects, but also identifying them in their various stages of life. We wouldn't want to smash a caterpillar that's going to become a pretty butterfly, right? But then the Cerculeo weevils that might attack your peach tree?
Yeah.
You might want to, so you have to kind of know the whole life cycle, right?
Yeah, it really helps a lot. That's why we included, at the beginning of each chapter in part two, chapter 10 deals with the insects, and we set it up for insects and then for fungi and then for bacteria, to define what they are, then what they do, and talk about the bright side, the good bugs, and then the dark side, and talk about the bad bugs, because it's pretty important to distinguish between the two, especially for insects, because there are a lot of what we call beneficial insects that are predators of the bad guys. And so you really want to invite those predators, like ladybugs, for example, into the garden, because they will help you by eating a lot of aphids.
Then you have some gloriously ugly photographs of fruits and vegetables in decline, and good old blossom end rots photographed, and botrytis, and many of the common ills and we see in tomatoes and other crops in the garden, but here they are pictured again.
You bet. We felt it was pretty important to include all these photographs so people can actually enter the book, enter the system in three different ways. They can leaf through the photos and find something that looks good, and then might be the solution that they're looking for. And then they really need to check with the flowcharts to make sure they've found the right thing, because there are different reasons for different things. So, the symptom can look very similar, but be the result of very different factors.
Mm-hmm. And then you show photos of, for lack of a better phrase, the teeth marks of birds and rodents and slugs and and snails and the damage they do unto themselves that are very identifiable once you separate them into pictures of each fruit being attacked by each particular bug.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's fabulous. It runs everything from perhaps an orchid that you may have in the house,
right,
to your vegetable garden, to herbaceous plants, woody plants, trees and shrubs. So pretty much covers everything in just a fabulously efficient way. I suspect that this book will remain on the kitchen table throughout the summer, along with my other favorite books that get me through the season. Yeah. David, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Good work.
All right. David Deardorff is the co-author, along with Catherine Wadsworth, of What's Wrong with My Plant and How Do I Fix It?, published by Timber Press. He spoke to us from his home in Washington State. And, of course, for more information on David and Catherine and their book, please go to our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Miss Wishy, we have a questioning public once again.
All right.
First one's for you.
Okay.
If you do well, I'll give you the second one.
Okay, thanks.
It's a question from Shane, who has a shrub that's an integral part of the landscape, but it's slowly dying in areas, those dreaded brown spots. And she wonders if he can bring that thing back to life. What do you think?
Well, in the picture that was sent along, it does, in fact, indicate that it's an Alberta spruce.
Right.
And it looks to me like it has a couple of different issues could be going on. I consider what our winter was like and that people used a whole lot of salt on the road, salt brine, okay, et cetera, maybe salt on the driveway. I can't really tell how the Alberta spruce is situated in terms of north, south, east, west, or if there's a road on that burned side.
Okay.
But if there is, that could definitely be salt spray, you know, winter desiccation from the weather, right?
Yep.
If you look on the roads sides right now, do you see all the cedars kind of burned chest high, right?
Yep.
And it's from salt. So that could be it if that's the environment, right? Another thing, Alberta spruce are often susceptible by mite damage.
Yep.
So if you had mites maybe last fall, last summer into fall, and you're just now noticing the significant damage after the winter, that could be the case. What you want to do is put a piece of white paper underneath of that, tap on where the damage is, and see if you see any teeny specks. They could be white, green, or black, or red, rather, on that white piece of paper, and then that indicates that you have mites.
And the solution is?
You can use neem,
neem
to control mites or horticultural oils.
Right.
But the damage is done, quite frankly, when it comes to an evergreen like the Alberta spruce. So,
well, I've had them come back. I've pruned them back around the edges of those brown spots. And in a year or two,
you just have to be patient.
Yeah, you have to wait them out, but it'll be a while.
Yeah.
It's a neat plant, but boy, they're so susceptible to that exact problem.
So you did it if it's by a road where there was lots of salt applied, or check for mites.
Exactly.
Pretty common. Okay. All right. Next question, Bob. This one's from Jim. How close, or rather how far away from my septic system should I plant my white birch or my river birch trees?
Oh, Sellersburg.
Yeah. I would...
Cosmosdale, Cementville, one of those places. Not real close. And a true confession here, because I've got a birch tree over my septic system.
Do you?
Yeah, I put it in about 30 years ago, and I... so far, so good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a real dumb idea because white birches, among many trees, have really aggressive roots.
Well, they're water seekers, so they can really get in your lateral line. So I think like the lateral field, make sure it's not in your lateral field, right?
Yeah, mine is, so I'm waiting to see.
So basically know what the mature height and spread of the tree is, and know that the roots will stretch beyond the canopy of that tree.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll want to keep them well away from that lateral field. I would, quite frankly, choose another tree, you know, like a smaller, a dogwood, flowering crab apple, something like that, closer to that area, and get your birch at least 50 feet away, if not more.
And stay tuned. Bob will report on his over the next 30 or 40 years.
when it starts to fail, we'll hear about it. All right, Bob, one more. This one's got you written all over it. From Rick, I have a Harry Lauder walking stick that has gotten far too big for the spot it's in. How severely can I cut it back without killing it and still have it grow back and look good with time?
Well, they're pretty whackable. I've done mine several times, and it's a great plant, named for a guy named Harry Lauder, by the way, in British
very
entertainment.
Very contorted.
Yeah, very contorted, very interesting. Better in the winter than in the summer, really, for the looks. But anyway, you can cut back, but don't do much more than 20-25% of the time.
Yeah.
Just be careful with it. But they're very prunable, and those branches are really great in flower arrangements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are.
Use them all the time. You stick them in the vases with these flowers, and they're
fabulous
really fun.
Idea.
But
yeah.
Be judicious, but they're pretty tough. They can take it.
And don't, like, chop it off like haircut.
Oh, no.
You make your proper pruning cuts and thin it out, and as Bob said, no more than maybe 20-25% at the time, or
two
else
cuts,
you stress it out.
Two cuts, step back 2 feet. Mm-hmm. Two cuts, step back 4 feet.
Shape it up, yeah.
You betcha, yeah.
Don't butcher it.
Yeah.
All right.
If you have a question for us alleged garden experts, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's Plant Story Day. What do you have?
The perfect combination of tree and name for a great guy.
Oh.
Perfect. Best one I've ever done.
Is it Bob Hill Tree or something?
Well, that would be pretty close to this one. The Halesia.
Oh, okay.
Or Carolina Silverbell.
Sure.
You got those out there?
Got those out there.
God, I love those things. I got three cultivars. One's the regular Silverbell, or Halesia Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the two-winged one, the Halesia Diptera Magniflora, which is twice the size.
Mm-hmm.
My tree's about 30 feet tall, covered in these white bells. And just this past couple weeks, I got the pink one, the
We've
rosy.
Had that one for a couple of years.
Oh, no, you're ruining me. Isn't that something, though?
Yeah.
It is the most beautiful,
that
delicate.
That one's the prettiest, I think,
by
so
far.
It's just
mesmerizing.
It is.
And it's got nice bark. I like the bark. I like the tree a lot. It's a native of many areas in the U.S., actually from zones 4 to 9, which is good to know. It should be more popular, but it's not. It's about a 20 to 30-foot tree, a little fussy about soil, though mine do fine, semi-shade, acid side. Durr says they're better off planted from containers and B&B, and Durr would know, Michael Durr. There's also a mountain silver bell, the Monticola, which is 60 to 80 feet tall.
Wow.
Wouldn't that be something?
That would be something.
I would walk 50 miles backwards to see that puppy. Anyway, it's real pest resistant to boot. It's just a matter, I didn't sight mine real well, and they need to be in kind of a little grove or shaded area with a green background. It's just a fabulous tree. Named, I didn't know this, for a really good guy named Stephen Hales.
Huh.
Yeah, he was an English physiologist and a chemist who lived from 1677 to 1761, 84 years back then.
That's pretty impressive.
He did something right. Uh-huh. But Hales was one of the first guys to study air and water as related to plant maintenance.
Huh.
He gave accurate amounts of the movement of water in plants and demonstrated that plants absorb air back in the 1770s. Did a lot to help humans, too. He discovered the dangers of breathing stale air and invented a ventilator, which improved the lives on ships, hospitals, and prisons back in the 1700s.
Huh.
He invented surgical forceps, studied kidney stones, and suggested solvents which might reduce them without surgery.
So what's his connection to the silver bell?
Well, he's also a botanist.
Okay.
And he spent a lot of time with plants, studying plants. Of course, he was studying the maintenance with the air and the water. So
someone honored him by naming the plants after him.
Yeah, that's how it works, okay. And he died, and he was buried beneath a church where he worked for many years in Teddington, England. That's how I want to go.
That sounds cool.
But he had a big funeral. Comes with a poem.
All right.
Say what you wish of whatever you ails, but save some kindness for Stephen Hales, who saved many poor souls from anesthesia and was justly rewarded. The tree Halesia was named for him about 2 centuries past, a tree of great beauty, rarely surpassed. When gardeners gather their stories to tell, none could ring finer than the sweet silver bell. The air filled with chimes, both pink and white, some fine garden music to go with the sight. Ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee, and the great Stephen Hales and his wondrous tree.
Very nice.
He's a great guy. Nice.
It's a great treat, great especially treat. This time of the year. Yeah. All right, well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Sydney Edison and gardening for a lifetime. Mr. Hales at 86 might have appreciated Sydney Edison's book as well.
I guess so.
How do we keep on doing it as we get older? So we look forward to that.
Homegrown is produced by that great bell ringer, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.